Drodzy Państwo, już jest minuta po drugiej i Irenka właśnie wchodzi. To dobrze. Czyli możemy zaczynać. Czekaliśmy na Ciebie, Irenko. Weź sobie słuchawki, kochanie, bo wykład będzie po angielsku. Masz słuchawki? Masz, dobrze. No a jak, skoro już... Drodzy Państwo, ladies and gentlemen, you know, that's the life. That's the life. Sometimes we have a wonderful, beautiful, bright and full of joy days, and sometimes we have rainy and I'm not gonna say sad days, but what I'm gonna say actually is that on the one hand we are so lucky and happy and proud and honored to have Professor Dan Bahat again in Krakow, yes. And this is phenomenal news. That's what makes this rainy, dark day so bright, so sunny, so shiny. But on the other hand, this is the last lecture. Professor Dan Bahat and his wife, Anat, are leaving tomorrow. And it would be much easier for me to manage it if they could leave straight to Jerusalem. But you know what are they doing? They're going tomorrow to Warsaw. To Warsaw. Which is completely abroad. I don't know actually where is Warsaw, but I understand Professor. I understand him. There is a beautiful museum, Pauline. And Anat and Professor Bahat wants to see that. Anyway, this is the last this year, of course, a lecture. Honestly speaking, we put to the program the title of a lecture like Battle of for Zion. But I asked Professor to speak actually about the most important thing nowadays. 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, about connection between the Jerusalem, Zion, and the Jewish people. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm thrilled to welcome again Professor Dan Bahat.
Dziękuję bardzo, jak zawsze. Mi przykro jest, że nie mogę mówić po polsku, tylko po angielsku, bo mnie brak słów po polsku, żeby tego wykładu dać. So, actually, the topic which I do today, I will not say is political, but I will say it is inspired by politics. And what do I mean? To our greatest disappointment, some years ago, UNESCO, which should be the center of culture and education in the world, this is what is meant to do, unfortunately became a political institution, which is nothing better than other institutions of the United Nations, which are, instead of being neutral and really dealing with the topics they've got to deal, they are doing politics, and the result is that they've got distorted picture on almost any topic which comes when it refers to Israel. And one of the greatest absurds to show how far it reaches was a few years ago's decision that Jerusalem has got nothing to do with the Jews. And this was, I don't know if you even know about it, but the decision was so stupid that, you know, it is beyond words. I don't have to explain it even. And from this resulted many things like, if Jerusalem was not Jewish, what Jesus did in Jerusalem? Oh, not a problem. They came to the conclusion that Jesus was a Palestinian. And this is how they solved the problem. So you understand what absurd it is. To my greatest disappointment, Catholic countries like Spain, France, Italy, voted for the decision, you see, which actually is pulling the carpet from under the feet of the Christian belief altogether. So this is actually the reason for which I choose the lecture which I'm going to give today in order to show some of the things which may explain why do I think that the decision was not only stupid, it was also vicious, very, very bad, where politics wins. I would like only to mention one thing, which I always think of it. I'm surprised that all the heads of the United Nations don't remember that there was an institution that preceded them, the League of Nations. And the League of Nations finished when Mussolini conquered Ethiopia, then it was named Abyssinia, and they did not protest. They saw it as a normal thing. That's the way things should be. And this is actually was an attitude which brought an end to the League of Nations. I'm afraid that one day the United Nations, if it doesn't get up one day from the stupid dream of politicization of every aspect of life, maybe if they don't get up of it, it will also have an end. So I'm sorry that I said this. This is politics. I'm not a politician. But nevertheless, this is the feeling which brought me to lecture today, which you'll see is completely clean of politics. We start with the first picture, which shows the old city of Jerusalem. The picture I took on purpose from the north, not from the south, in order to look northwards, but from the north to look southwards, when you can see here the historical necklace of Jerusalem. This is called today the Hill of the City of David. Today it is outside of the city wall. I'll explain immediately. This is the city which was conquered by King David. And then King Solomon built on this very spot where the mosque is. He built the Temple Mount, surrounding it by walls. And later, one of the greatest kings of ours, King Hezekiah, 200 years after King Solomon, namely in the 8th century, established a new city on the hill, this hill here, which includes Mount Zion, which is outside the city wall. This is the city wall. The Armenian Quarter, which is here, you see, the Jewish Quarter, which is here. Later, in a later period, around the time of King Herod, also the city expanded further north. Outside of the city was an area which was actually outside the city, and I mention it because here is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which must be outside of the city, and later the Muslim quarter, which occupies actually all that area like this. You see, the city in the Second Temple period, the city in the time of Herod was completely different from what you see today. Because the picture which you see today of the city, you see it is quite squarish. It is a square city, as it was built by Herod, the Imperator Hadrian, the Emperor Hadrian, who built it like as a square city in order to obliterate the memory of Jews in the country. Not only that, he also changed the name of the country. Jerusalem always was in Judah. He changed the name and started to call it Palestina Prima, and that's how there are Palestinians today, and the land is called sometimes Palestine. Actually, today, there is a Google published, we just saw it in the morning in the internet, very interesting. They decided to make an international quiz to ask, how should we call in our Google Maps, many of you probably know Google Maps, how shall we call the country, Israel or Palestine? And they ask everybody to press their two flags, or Israeli flags and Palestinian flag, to press the one which you think should be. And thank God to this very moment, it is 66% for Israel, but 33% for Palestine, which actually does not exist. Palestine is not a Semitic name. The Arabs are also Semites. Why do they want this foreign name? Only God knows. Not only God knows, I know exactly why. At any rate, this is the story. Now, you see the same picture now from the south, and I do it on purpose to show it this way, to explain that the most important part of biblical Jerusalem, like this one, the hill of the city of David and Mount Zion, were included in the city wall. It was a part of the city wall. The city wall in the north was also included in the city wall. But Hadrian, when he built his city in the shape of a Roman city, which must be flat in order to have streets which are parallel to each other, here you can see very well, still the Roman street, the traces of the Roman street of Jerusalem, can you see? And there is another street which goes here from Jaffa Gate, and you can see to this very day going like this. In other words, when you come today to Jerusalem, to the old city, you are actually walking in a street with a Roman plan. The inside of the city, it was changed a few times. Today, I believe that the city as it looks today is the result of the Crusaders from the 12th century. Many churches were converted to mosques, and you can't imagine, in this little city, which is less than 1 square kilometer, there are, we know by name or by ruins, over 43 churches. Over 43 churches. There's no city in the world, I think, which has got so much. Today you don't see them. Some were changed to storehouses, some were changed to offices, some were changed to mosques during the centuries. But nevertheless, it is essentially the Crusader city. Now, this is a landscape of Jerusalem before Jerusalem was founded. I mean, I want to say the natural topography of Jerusalem. The most important thing is the Kedron Valley, which comes down here. Another valley, the Valley of Hinnom, from which you know the word Gehenna, that is what it was. The central valley of Jerusalem, which is here. The Temple Mount, which is this one, the City of David. And this is the Western Hill. This is the Western Hill, which is known as Zion. Mount Zion is here. Armenian Quarter is here. Jewish Quarter is here. Christian Quarter is here. Church of the Holy Sepulchre is somewhere here. And then you've got the north of the city. You see that Jerusalem is a city on mountains. Today, when you walk in the city, you don't think of it, but here and there you go up a street, down a street. The result is because of what we see here. This is identical picture, but more, let's say, scientific. You can see again Mount Moriah, the center of which is the temple. Here you have got the city of David. Jewish quarter is here. Armenian quarter, Mount Zion. Christian quarter is here. And you see here is a part which is flat because it was a quarry. And this is where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is. So altogether you can see this city is very, very based on topography. The development of the city through history is always according to the topographical lines. What made Jerusalem a city of importance can be seen here. When King David decided to come to Jerusalem and to make it as a capital, it was in the center of the tribe of Judah. He ruled for 7 years. That's what the book of Samuel says. He ruled in Hebron, which is the capital of Judah. He ruled for 7 years, and then he understood that if he will rule from Jerusalem, the tribes of the north will not accept him. So he went to one of the tribes, which was in the story of the family of Jacob, was the smallest one, the youngest one. It was called Benjamin. So he decided he will go to the land of Benjamin, because the biblical description of the family of Jacob, that all the tribe loved, all the other people of the family, all the 12, loved very much Benjamin. He was the youngest. And to this very day in Hebrew, we have got an expression of somebody who is liked by many others. They say he is the Benjamin of whoever it is. So what did he do? He decided to make it in the land of Benjamin. And the interesting thing is that naturally the line should be like this. But the Bible, which was written, the Old Testament, which was written, do something like this, a kind of an enclave to put Jerusalem in Benjamin. You see, although by natural topography it should be a part of Judah. But nevertheless, it was accepted as Benjamin, and David understood that this is how it should be. They're of the tribe of Benjamin. When you look further closer to the land of Benjamin, and I'm sorry that I don't have it, this map in Polish, I have it only in Hebrew. Look, this is where Jerusalem is. You see, completely in a kind of an enclave. Moreover, from the geographical point of view, when you go today in the country, in the mountainous part of the country, you'll see that the mountains north of Jerusalem are 1,000 meters and more, and the mountains to the south are 1,100 meters high. Only Jerusalem is a kind of a depression. It is much lower. The highest mountain in Jerusalem, which is Mount Scopus, is only 850 meters. The old city of Jerusalem, the biblical nucleus, for example, the city of David, the bottom part where the famous pool of Siloam is, which is very well known in Christian tradition as a site where Jesus healed the blind, it is only 690 meters above sea level, 700 meters. So you understand that it was easy for people who go from the coastal plain or from the Jordan Valley, the easiest place was to go to Jerusalem, and this was one of the reasons why David chose it. This is the hill of the city of David, and this is a very, very interesting and problematic thing. In what sense it is diplomatic? Problematic. The story about the city of David, you see, this is the hill, very natural. This is where the pool of Siloam is. You can see the hill. And one of the problems is that all the excavations which were carried out here did not find remains from the 10th century BC, which is the time of King David and Solomon. The reason for that is that the place was robbed when the Emperor Hadrian built Jerusalem to be a pagan city over the ruins of the Jewish city. What did he do? Instead of going to a quarry and cut stones, he dismantled all the buildings which were in the hill of the city of David and reused the stones. Amongst them were many from the time of King David. The problem, why is it problematic? Because many people, many scholars believe that since the capital of King David is not what it should be, because if the biblical description is that David was such a great king, how comes there are no remains in the city of David? So one of our friends, an archaeologist, she did something very interesting. She went and checked all the places which were excavated in the past, not in modern ways as we do archaeology today, and she found one corner which is more or less here. One corner, you see, a part is built because during the time of Jordan, the Jordanians did not have any respect to the place, and they built on the hill, which is again is the historical nucleus of the city. So they built over it, which also disturbed the scholarly study of the hill of the city of David. But she excavated there, and she discovered remains of the 10th century. It was the first time that we know that King David, indeed, his city was there, maybe a certain fortification even, and so on. I bring you this picture, which is a model which we built in 1996 in one of the museums in Israel, in Jerusalem, the Bible and Museum. And we tried, with all the data which we have, with all the given data which we have, to try and to reconstruct how was Jerusalem more or less in the time of King David. So what we can see here, first of all, is the temple. And one of the questions which still have today, to which there is no definite answer, did the temple at that time have an enclosure, which means an area to create a kind of a piazza around the temple? We don't really know. Because the first time when we hear about a piazza around the temple was in the days of Esdras and Nehemiah, which means after repatriation from Babylon. So till then, we really don't know. On the other hand, very interesting, the whole series of buildings which you see here, probably they're more beautiful than they were in reality, but I cannot say. Of course, these are the palaces of King Solomon. Now, one of the things, when you open the Bible, the Old Testament, and you read about Solomon, you'll find out that since in the first book of the Kings is description of his building the temple. And then in very short, they describe him building his palace. But when you read about the palace and when the Bible gives data, you'll find out that the palace is much, much, much bigger than the temple. So it is, probably it was very impressive. I'll tell you more than that. We know that in those days, in the East, palace is not built as one solid building. There is no such a thing. Like, you know, today, you know, England has Buckingham Palace, France has got Versailles. Here you have got even the Wawel, the Royal Palace, if you want, and so on. But not in the Oriental world. In the Oriental world, palaces were, and they are still today, pavilions. If somebody has been, the best example I can give you to understand it, if somebody has been to Spain, to Granada, has seen the Alhambra, even if you haven't seen, you saw pictures, and you see that it is comprising of courts. That's how the palace is. Exactly the same phenomenon we have here. And here we have got a big citadel at the end, which was named in book Samuel, when David conquers Jerusalem from the Jebusites, the Bible says, and he settled in the citadel of Zion, and he called it the city of David, which means the name of David already shows from very beginning. Beyond that, on this hill, is what was built later by King Hezekiah. It was exactly there, easy to remember, 700 B.C., What happens in 700 B.C.? The Assyrian king Sennacherib comes to Jerusalem, and King Hezekiah fortifies the city by city walls in order to be ready for the siege. This is another view of the city. I do it again and again because I want to give you the feeling that our knowledge of the hill of the city of David and what is going there is growing from one year to the other. Every year brings more finds and more finds to learn. This is another one. You see, we do it so much because, and I'll tell you, sometimes, you know the story of a lecturer who is lecturing, and in certain minutes he's shouting. So his apprentice asks him, what is that? He says, look, whenever I'm not convinced in something, or I'm afraid people will not be convinced, I'm shouting it. It's exactly what we are doing today. We know so much about the hill of the city of David, but not enough. So what do? Everyone thinks that he will do a better reconstruction, and so finally we'll have the real picture. Of course, the basis to everything is the fact that in the hill of the city of David is the only spring, the only water source in Jerusalem, which is called the Gihon, and you can see the Gihon again plays very important thing. By the spring of Gihon, the king of Judah were anointed to become kings. And you see, it is a perennial spring which still runs today, and it is still a joy for many tourists who like to walk in a tunnel which was excavated by King Hezekiah to walk from the spring to the pool of Siloam to wet your trousers or to wet your legs. And people are happy to do it, especially in summer when it is quite hot. So this is really a very important feature in Jerusalem. You see the spring, or you go down, and then you walk the whole walk all the way along. This is a system which shows you that King Hezekiah made all kind of works, like from the spring, he made an aqueduct which goes all the way down to Pool of Siloam, although it preceded by others' installations. Everyone tried to find a way how to get water into the city, even in case of siege, because the spring was outside of the city. All that is very interesting. In the last few years, we have discovered something else, which to me is extremely, extremely important, also from the Christian point of view. You know that the first time that Jerusalem is mentioned in the Bible, it is not called Jerusalem, it is called Salem. Salem only, Salem. Because Jerusalem means the God Salem has founded it. God Salem was the god of the night in the Canaanite pantheon. And the interesting thing is, when is it mentioned first time? When Abraham meets Melchizedek. Abraham meets Melchizedek. And Abraham gives Melchizedek one-tenth of all the things which he brought from after his battle against the kings of the Dead Sea. In Psalm it says Melchizedek is mentioned a second time, and there it says that God said that Melchizedek, he is his eternal priest. I don't know if you remember that one. Therefore, in Christianity, sometimes, Melchizedek is compared to Jesus. And therefore, you can see, for example, when you go to the great cathedrals of Europe, you can see where you see all the statuary, you can see Abraham and Melchizedek are equal. They're equal, or Melchizedek sometimes even taller, because Abraham gave him one-tenth. To whom you give one-tenth? To God. This is the Jewish law. One-tenth of your fruit, of your products, you give to God. And if Abraham gives to God, to Melchizedek, one-tenth, you can understand the conclusion. Why do I speak about it so much? Because all the system which you see, I've shown here Hezekiah, but look at all those installations which include city wall, include cistern, includes another channel to bring water. All this is 18th century. 18th century, according to the scholars who believe in the existence of Abraham, you see I'm doing it very carefully, they all believe that Abraham lived in the 18th century BC. Yes, almost 4,000 years ago. If this is the thing, maybe it is not surprising that 4,000 years ago we see all those installations, because archaeologists who dug it, they did not think of it. They thought we are digging something, and according to the pottery and other finds, it is 18th century. There is no way but to connect Abraham and Melchizedek with him with the discoveries of all this water system, which is very exciting. And every year, more and more facts are being discovered of this. This is a map which shows the greatness of the works, like all the towers which surround. You see, this is where the spring is here. And you see from here, this is actually Hezekiah. But look at all those enormous installations, including the big pool. You know what? I cannot tell you how impressive it is unless you are there. So you must really to understand the greatness of the works which were carried out in the 18th century BC. 18th century BC, Abraham. Abraham, why? You can ask me, why do I say that Abraham lived in the 18th century and Melchizedek with him? Because this is a period which in the history of the Middle East is called the Hyksos period, when Egypt and our country was one. Therefore, all the Israelites could go back and forward to Egypt. There are many, many reasons that we know that occurred at that time. I cannot go into details, but I think the conclusion is all the great fortifications which you see here in yellow, all those kind of things, are all made 18th century BC, which is probably the time of Abraham. This is an aqueduct which was excavated in the rock to bring water. Now you walk in it, you can walk, that's why there are lights there. This is 18th century BC. Imagine to dig in the hard rock when there is no iron yet. It is a period when the material which was used was bronze. By bronze to dig such a thing in the hard stone of Jerusalem, you see that the project was really great. This is a picture of the tower, and I'm going on. That's actually reconstruction of what we have seen. You see, look at the tower. Really great, great work. And the result is what you see here of the 18th century. You see, here is the temple. Here is the citadel of Zion. And these are the installations to bring water. Here is, inside here is the spring, the big pool which I've explained, and aqueduct. This is the course of Kedron Valley. Here it shows water, but this is only in rain time. Otherwise it is dry. So altogether, you see, the history starts very early. In the 9th century, in the days probably after Solomon or during, they tried to do another approach to the water. They made an enormous system of going down, enormous system, how you go from the city into the spring in order to obtain water even in case of siege. Look at the stairwell. Now you have got it all modern, but in the rock is cut another stairwell which is made of stone, I mean the cut in the rock, and you go down and down and down. Look, it's another part. You continue in tunnels and tunnels. All is done there. Why do I say it? Why do I show it to you? It's because of simple reason. The 9th century BC is already clearly Judaic. It is after David, after Solomon. It has got some of the greatest kings of Judah, such as Jehoshaphat, Asa, which are mentioned in the Old Testament. And so I can show you all the time that the city non-stop has got connection to the place. Here you can see another part of the tunnel, and so it goes another part of the tunnel, and another shaft going down. Look at the great work which was carried out. And it is a very serious work. It is over 80 meters. You have got all kinds of systems of tunnels in order to reach the spring. And this is a plan of the hill of the city of David. So as you see, city of David, as I say, historical nucleus of Jerusalem, and hence the great importance. The line which you see is the aqueduct which was excavated by King Hezekiah, and a famous inscription which is found today in Istanbul describes the moment of the meeting of the two groups who excavated. You see, it is full of water, and this is the inscription which is today in the Archaeological Museum of Istanbul, because it was found on the wall where the two groups who excavated met. And now, maybe I should take this inscription, bring it to UNESCO, who sit in Geneva, in Switzerland, and show them. You see, it is written in Arabic, of course. You see, it is ancient Hebrew. Yes, but according to UNESCO, it should be written in Arabic, because they are the ones who are connected. It should be written, I won't say Arabic, it should be written in Palestinian. Yes, it is the longest inscription which we have got from the time of the kings of Judah, and it describes an amazing thing. It describes two groups are coming one against the other, each one is hitting the rock, and the other one is hitting the rock. And you know, when you knock on the rock, sometimes you don't know where it comes from. And they describe how they go one against the other, one against the other, one against the other, till the great moment, one hits with the hammer. All is described here in amazing, beautiful biblical Hebrew. He hits the rock, and suddenly there is an opening, and what does he see? His friend from the other side who is standing there. It is such a dramatic moment that it is unbelievable. And it is all written in the ancient Hebrew script, which was used by the Jewish people till the exile to Babylon. Later it changed, because after the exile of Babylon, people started to use the square Hebrew, the one which we are using today. So this is actually a beautiful thing. It was all neglected during the centuries. Jerusalem under the Muslims was quite a neglected city many times. And this is the spring which was discovered. This is where the spring is. You can see hardly anything. It became a place of pilgrimage to the Christians many times because of the story that Jesus healed the blind man there. And it is the moment that the church was discovered. You can see here the beautiful walls of the church. The moment that the church was discovered in 1897, at this very moment, the Muslims built a mosque on it, so that no one, you see, there is the minaret of the mosque, in order that no church can be built here. Fortunately, today, in these very days, excavations, underground excavations, are discovering slowly the remains of the church which was there. It was an amazing church built in the 5th century by the Christians. You can see here the church itself, which has a direct descent by steps to go into the Pool of Siloam as it was there. Today we know that the real Pool of Siloam was elsewhere, that the Pool of Siloam was, you see, this is what is left. The bottom is the remains of the Pool of Siloam, as it was believed to be by the Christians, and above it you can see all the modern structure is a mosque. But today, what we have today, you see, this is what is left. You see, this is what is left, and this is what the real pool is like. We have excavated in the last few years a great section of the pool, which was a square pool. You see one line here. Imagine one line should go that way, and come back here. You understand? And all around it was surrounded by enormous stairwell, which is very important to say that even a blind person can come down on those steps and go down to the water. The water is here. Very, very exciting. When this was discovered for us, it was a great surprise. Now it forms a part of a visit to the city of David. You look how impressive it is. And definitely you can understand that such a discovery now, many groups of pilgrims who come to Jerusalem don't go anymore to this little pool I've showed you, which is covered by the mosque, but they're coming now here, understanding that this is the true place where the events of Jesus healing the blind are here. This is where it was. This is a kind of a reconstruction. I don't know if it is exactly the same reconstruction, but it gives you an idea how it was. Remember, I'm speaking all the time of Jerusalem in the First Temple period, which is very important because it shows the development of the city, works which are being carried out, and of course only archaeology can do. This is how it was believed to be today, but as I told you, now we've got a clearer picture. Another pool, which is from the First Temple period, from the time of a Jewish king, is this one. This is a pool which is called Bethesda. Everyone, when I say Bethesda, remember another place where a miracle was done by Jesus when he healed the blind. This is the pool as it was in the First Temple period, namely in the time of the kings of Judah. They had here a dam, and in the center of the dam there was a pit. Inside the pit there were many holes, so the people could regulate how high should be the water behind the dam. And it was important because it was in case there is no rain in this year, to let less water go and so on. The interesting thing that when you read the New Testament, you read a story that actually it was a different way. It was in a way with five porticos. And indeed, the five porticos, or how they were, is well known to us in antiquity. Jerusalem starts as a Canaanite city. And you can see here two houses which were excavated, which date from the 32nd century BC, which means over 500, it will be about 5,000 years ago. Over 5,000 years ago, already there you can see the city with all what it has, typical pottery which we know, and then first time it is mentioned in Egyptian sources. What you can see here is a picture of a statue. In Egypt, you know that our country is considered always by the Egyptians as a gateway to Egypt, because when you come from the north, only when you pass through our country, then you've got the desert of Sinai, and then you've got Egypt. That's how it is. So all the invaders who came to Egypt from the north, if it was the Assyrians, if it was the Babylonians, when it was the Greeks, if it was the Romans, always had to pass. We did not enjoy this neighborhood. Definitely did not enjoy the neighborhood, because whoever wanted to conquer Egypt, and everybody wanted to conquer Egypt, had to pass through our country and to conquer our country first. This is how the Romans conquered our country and so on. Now, what is that? In the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, namely 19th century BC, the country was ruled by Egypt. But the Egyptians could not make any every year to send the army to oppress the nations that they have conquered. So they found magic. They made statues. On each statue was written the name of a city. And when the city rebelled, they broke the statue. They believed that if they break the name of the city, they will be able to oppress revolt in case there is a revolt. And this is very important because Jerusalem becomes already so important. It is the only city that is marked twice in two different occasions. Jerusalem is marked, is mentioned as a city with one prince, already a very important city, already as I show here from the 19th century BC. That's exactly as Jerusalem was the importance. Another document, which is extremely important, in the 14th century, again, the country is ruled by Egypt, but many enemies are coming from all around. So every king of every city, there were city-states, and not one state as it is today, every city was attacked by enemies. And all sometimes one city is attacking the other one to gain more territory. The result is that people write to Egypt letters asking for help from the Egyptian kings. Those letters from the 14th century were found. We have got about 300 of them. The interesting thing that out of the 300, six are from Jerusalem, more than any other city. In other words, Jerusalem was in the center of a large area which is it ruled, and every time somebody else from the surrounding cities tried to conquer it. Why is it so important to us? Because not always archaeology can give you all the details about it, but the fact that it is mentioned in Egyptian sources helps us to understand that indeed Jerusalem was an important city, and in spite of the fact that there is no archaeological finds, because as I told you, the hill of the city of David was badly destroyed by Hadrian, therefore the only way by which we can know the history of the city is thanks to the document which we get from other things. Here you can have it. This is the letter from Jerusalem. It is written in cuneiform, the writing which was widespread in Mesopotamia, because the lingua franca, the common language to all, as today let's say is English, was Akkadian. It was a language which was written not hieroglyphs, but cuneiform. This is the way of the script. So this is the book from Jerusalem. And of course, as I told you, remains of the palace of King David were discovered. What you can see here in the picture, the walls and everything which you see here, are all actually remains of the palace, very poor. And another problem which we have here, that's why it was not extended. Remember I told you that during the Jordanian time, they started to build on the hill of the city of David. So we are limited. We have got to dig between the houses. That's all what we can do. We cannot do more. But with the discovery of the buildings which date from the time of King David, we know, of course, of the existence of buildings at that time. You see, this is all what is left. Very little. And you know what? I don't speak about this, which is late. But look, a piece of a pavement here, a piece of a pavement here, a wall here. Really very little remains, because a lot was robbed by Emperor Hadrian and the other by the archaeologists from the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, who did not know yet how to build. And therefore, because of that, the problem was that many people say, listen, King David is a legend. So I bring this, I actually showed it also yesterday for those who have been, but I don't mind to repeat. This was found in Tel Dan, which is the most north city of the country. This city was conquered by the Arameans, whose center was in Damascus. And one day, King Hazael of the Arameans conquered Israel, managed to defeat the Israeli army. I mean Israel because remember that after the days of King Solomon, the country was divided, Judah and Israel. So this was Israel, which has got nothing to do with the Davidic dynasty. Nevertheless, in spite of the fact that this monument, unfortunately we found only two pieces of it, when they want to define Israel, not Judah, Israel, which as I say is not connected to David, and 150 years after King David, how does he want to call Israel? The House of David. You see, here is written, the House of David. In Hebrew, Beit David, the House of David, which means the memory of David. 100 years later, even in Israel, was so great that the Arameans called Israel the House of David. So how can you deny the existence of David and his importance in world politics at the time? You see, this is the hill of the city of David. And here excavations took place, which describes so much of what we have there. Then we go on with history. The people go to Babylon, to the exile, and then they come back and they rebuild the temple. The temple which they rebuilt was smaller than the temple which we know as Herod's temple. And something very important. The country is conquered by Alexander the Great, Alexander Macedon. This happened in the year 330. And since then, the Greeks, or rather they were called the Seleucids, because the center was in Antioch in northern Syria. They found that they're descendants of, you know, the generals of Alexander the Great, and they start to give problem to Jerusalem. And what do they do in order to control Jerusalem against the Jews? And do we know about it where from? From the book of Maccabees. They built in Jerusalem a great fortress. And what you can see in this picture is the fortress which was built by the Greeks in order to oppress any possibility of revolt of the Jews in Jerusalem. You see, against the Jews in Jerusalem, it is a long chain of stories which I can go on. Look at the size, look at the height. So impressive. But, of course, it was the day it was conquered. You know, the rebellion of Judas Maccabeus was in 167 BC. And then his brother Simeon, only in 143, managed to conquer the citadel, which was built in Jerusalem by the Greeks. And so only since then, Judah was completely liberated. I'm skipping only to show you some pictures of the hill of the city of David, which was thoroughly excavated and really does not have, in the chain of the history which I want to tell, is different. Look at that. The city as it is in the end of the first temple period. The upper part here is Muslim. It destroyed it, but this is all from the time of the kings of Judah. Jerusalem of the first temple period was a great prosperous city, and actually King David, by founding it, and the kings of his dynasty who continued afterwards, made Jerusalem what it is. No other city, neither in our country nor in the near Middle East, has got this history and this knowledge and the fame which the kings of Judah gave to Jerusalem. This is a plan of a neighborhood which was built by probably King Jotam, one of the kings of Judah. He made a kind of tower and fortifications and all that in the hill of the city of David. Unfortunately, most of them are after the 10th century BC, which means not from the days of King David, but probably much later. The large tower which you see here, this one, to some scholar dates from the time of King Solomon. So there is still something. Unfortunately, we don't have the temple, and so I cannot refer to it. This is a different story. You see a construction of a part of the fortification of Jerusalem in the first temple period. So you can see really how Jerusalem is all the time. Jerusalem all the time, the first temple period, that's the beginning of the connection between the Jewish people and Jerusalem, and it will go on like this for the rest of history. Look at the mighty way by which Jerusalem was built at that time. These are the walls of these are the remains also of an administrative center in Jerusalem. This wall is Byzantine, namely from the period when the Roman Empire becomes Christian, but all the rest is, of course, from the first temple period. And it goes like this, I can go on like this days and days. The beautiful thing and the most important discovery which was made in the last great discovery of Israelite Jerusalem is this. You can see an enormous wall which runs here from the days of King Hezekiah. It was cut. You see here are other structures. These are crusaders, but it shows how Jerusalem expanded under the Jews. It is important to say, because in the background of all the other cities in our country, in the Near East, actually this one is the most prominent, the largest, and of course the best known, thanks of course to the Old Testament which describes the city. Look at the size of the masonry and everything which is done by the Jews. And again, this is a general plan. The part of the wall which I've just shown you from the days of Hezekiah is this part here. You see? So altogether, temple area, city of David, and extension by Hezekiah. Altogether, it shows you how important this was. And look at that. This is amazing. These were found in Jerusalem, and they indicate the fact that there was a royal palace, which we don't know where it is. You know, it is. I'll tell you what these are. These are when there was a window. The window was large, And let's say in modern terms, I'll say so that children will not fall down. They put this on the wall, on the floor of the window. Yes, the window. And on the floor of the window, they put this so that you can stand, look out from the window, put your hand like this on it and look outside, which means it forms a lower part of a window. We know that this is royal because we've got it not only in Jerusalem, it is also found in Syria and in other royal palaces of Assyria and so on. So we know that also Jerusalem in the time of the first temple period had a beautiful and most lavish palace. The problem is that the remains of it were not found yet. Another thing which shows the royalty of Jerusalem is this one, because this one shows you a capital of a column in the palace. It was not found in the palace, unfortunately. Had we found it in the palace, we would have known where it is. But the fact that it is found in Jerusalem shows that there was a palace. God knows where, but there was a palace. And this type of capitals, which we have, for example, you know, those of you who know Greek architecture know the Ionian capitals, with the volutes. This is actually father of this idea. You see, it came from the Middle East. And here is another thing which is of great importance. All the family of David's family of King David were buried in the hill of the city of David. So I put here an example at the surface of the hill of the city of David. But if you look at it well, you see that actually all is a quarry. You can see exactly the size of stones which were taken from everywhere. When they made out of the hill of the city of David, when they made of it a quarry, what did they discover? Two tunnels. One is here and one is here. It is not exactly a tunnel. It is a cave which is about 20 meters long. These are the royal tombs. Probably these are the tombs of David's family. And the reason why we think so is that when Hezekiah excavated his tunnel to bring water, when he came to this area and he knew that up there are the tomb, he made a whole curve so not to go under the tomb, the royal tombs of the family of David. Because we know that the Bible says, every king who died says, and he lied with his father in their tombs in the city of David. We know that all were buried there. The problem is, and you know it when we start to deliberate about the authenticity of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Jews are not allowed to bury inside the city. But here you can see that the tombs are in the city of David. What to do with it? The sages found a solution. Because what is the problem? The problem that is a dead body is impure. Impurity was a very important factor in Judaism. So if you have a dead body in a town, all the people in the town are contaminated. They are impure. What to do about it? So they found a solution. And according to the Jewish law, the bodies of King of David, of the family of King David, since they were anointed in the name of the Lord, the bodies of the kings of the dynasty of David are not impure. You see, this is how they solve the problem. Fantastic solution. But you see, that's how we can understand why they could live together with the tombs of King David inside the city and not to become impure. You see, this is another picture which I brought only to show you the damages which Emperor Hadrian in the second century did to the city of David. So don't be surprised that we have nothing. You see, you can see it very well here. Another picture of it, yes. And another thing, the tombs of the time are beautiful. If only archaeologists can say a beautiful tomb. You can see here a little room with a door. This is today serving an Arab outside of the hill of the city of David. Here it is where he holds his chicken. But actually, it is a tomb from the first temple period. And look at the stone, how beautifully they are cut. Especially if you look at the facade all this. It is so smooth, you don't believe even that already in the time of the kings of Judah, they could make such beautiful facades of tombs. Look at that, how beautiful it is. It is another tomb. We traditionally believe to be the tomb of the daughter of Pharaoh, who was the wife of King Solomon, but we know that it is not, but at least we see the work is really beautiful. And sometimes even there is an inscription. And in this inscription, you can see two Hebrew letters. One is this one, and another one is this one. The word will be, the meaning of the word, we note it. But why is it cut? Is because of simple reason. When those tombs were, the opening were very small. But after the victory of Christianity, all the tombs along the valley became houses for hermits, for monks who lived in them, and they could not enter through the little opening, so they extended it. Because originally, here was the opening down to here, and here it was, there is a depression in order to write something, and I know what it means. Very funny, you see, from two letters, I can tell you what the whole thing will see. Because these two letters means people who are accursed, somebody accursed. What will be? What do you mean accursed? Here lies this and this man. Whoever opens his tomb will be accursed. You understand? They will occur him. Yes? Accursed. So that's actually, we know that they are also from the first temple period. The most beautiful inscription, I took this picture in the British Museum in London because the British also robbed our country. And you see, with the chalk, you can see the inscription, which comes from the first same cemetery where other tombs. And this one is amazing. It says as follows. I'll show you. Here lies, this is broken, Yahu, many Jewish names like Hizkiyahu, Yirmiyahu, and so on, who is the Major Domus. There is no gold here, no silver. Here inside are only the bones of himself and his mistress. Do not open it. Occurred will be the one who opens. You see? Beautiful inscription. It is so beautiful that the British robbed it. You see? Very beautiful in the British Museum. Look at the letters. This is a typical Hebrew word. You remember the two letters I showed you in the previous one? You've got them here. One is here and one is here. In the middle, the letter is a vocal in this case, the letter Vav. But the whole word here says Arur, or cursed. You see exactly, that's why we know what was written in the other one which I have shown you. Look how beautiful. This is a typical tomb of the time, of people of importance. You can see there is an entrance, rooms, and always the dead will be put. They make them even something to put their head on. You see, the head of the deceased. He will lie there as long as he got flesh. When there are only bones, because this is a family tomb, and new people of the family die, where to put them? So when the body becomes only bones, only skeleton, they'll take it down, and under those beds, so to say, is a cave. They'll put everything inside there. And so we have got here cemetery, beautiful. You can't imagine, picture doesn't show how beautiful it is carved in the rock, so smooth, so beautiful to make these really tombs. One of the things which was discovered in the city of David is a figure, a royal figure, you see, with a crown or something like that. This might have been one of the kings of Judah. No, the kings of Judah were not so beautiful as you see, but nevertheless, they were beautiful. I don't think that the Bourbons are nicer. At any rate, you can see there are many inscriptions written in the ancient Hebrew. You see, this is ancient Hebrew. Very important. Why do I bring it? Like the inscription we just seen, like the inscription which comes from the tunnel of Siloam, like this inscription, you must admit one thing. They are not written in Palestinian. This is what I want to show you. That's very, very important for us. Look, all this is Hebrew. All our inscriptions which come from the city of David. All of them, all are written in the same inscription. And so on, we can go on like this. Here I bring already, on the right-hand side, we've got a great, great tower, which is kept to a height of 18 meters. 18 meters, enormous, from the days of King Hezekiah. And you know what the amazing thing is here? You see, here is a burnt floor. The burnt floor is very interesting because when the Babylonians fought for Jerusalem, they shoot arrows. So whenever the arrows enter to the holes, they remain there, and the archaeologists had only to take and to put them out. But the ones who hit the stone, they fell down here, and these were found. We've got here the best evidence to the conquest of Jerusalem by King David. And you see all the city walls like this one and other fell down. From the kings of Judah, the only remains which we have is this stone here. What is this? You remember I showed you the picture of those things which look like palm tree on which you stand in a window. This was found just outside of the old city of Jerusalem. What happens there? One of the kings of Judah, whose name was King Uzziah, was leper. So he could not stay in his palace. So what did they do? What did he do? He built just outside of the old city, he built himself a palace. And those things, which I say, those things, come from his palace. And the interesting thing is that during the Second Temple period, after the exile in Babylon, maybe they wanted to build around somewhere where he was buried, because him they could not bury with the other kings because he was a leper. They buried him elsewhere. But in the Second Temple period, after they came back from Babylon, in the Hellenistic period, they had respect to the king, and they wanted to put him in a respectful place. So what did they do? They took all the bones of King Uzziah, they knew who he was, and they buried him elsewhere. And the place where they buried him, they put as the rolling stone. Rolling stone is not always round. Sometimes rolling stone is straight. They put this one. This was on the tomb. Look at the beauty of the stone. And it says like this: to here were brought the bones of Uzziah, the king of Judah, and do not open it. You see? The script, though, is already more known to you, because this is the first time after the exile of Babylon, they already write it in the square letters, which you know today. It is still not as modern as the way we'll write it today, but every Israeli child of 6 who can read will be able already to read it. The problem is that this stone was not found in place. It was found in the collection of the Russian Patriarch of Jerusalem in the 19th century. In other words, he bought it somewhere, or maybe he found it somewhere, we don't know. What a pity that we don't know where it comes from. It would have been to us to know where the tomb was. The destruction of the temple and the reconstruction of the Second Temple has got its impression in one of the most exciting documents in the ancient world. This is written in cuneiform. It was published by King Cyrus in Sweden, in Persia, in Iran. And King Cyrus says here that he gave, in the name of God Merodach, he gave every nation the right to go back and to rebuild his temple and to worship its God. We have got the identical text we have got in the book of Ezra. The only difference is that instead of the name of Merodach, is the name of the Jewish God. That's all. Otherwise, it is exactly the same thing. So I want only to show you what I started to do now. I don't want to keep you any longer, but I want to show you that all the time, the existence of the Judeans, let us put it this way, the Judeans, first of all, the Jews altogether, or the Israelites altogether, and then the Judean. At the beginning of the years, after the foundation of the Jewish people in its country, Jerusalem already plays an important role. And I'd like to mention something very important. You know that every Jew who is praying, he's mentioning Jerusalem and the reconstruction of Jerusalem and the building of Jerusalem and the building in Jerusalem, is always six times a day he says it. In the three prayers of the day, the three daily prayers, and in the three prayers of the food, yes, which we do. And altogether, where every holiday, every celebration, it ends with the word next year in Jerusalem, which means actually that we hope that from now to the next year, you'll come and be in Israel. That's Zionism, that all the Jews should live in Jerusalem. And I say it with this word, next year in Jerusalem, I want to tell you that I hope that next year, God willing, I'll be here again and continue the story of the Jews of Jerusalem. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, if there are any questions, if you have problem, you can ask in Polish. It will be okay with me.
Do you find many inscriptions in Aramaic?
In inscription in Aramaic?
Yes.
Of course we have. Ah, that's a good question. I'll tell you why it is a good question. One of the discussions is always if Jesus spoke Hebrew or Aramaic. I'm quite sure that this is the background of your question. Yes, we have got inscription in Aramaic. Jesus spoke Hebrew. That's more and more we are convinced. Although I want to say when Jesus was on the cross, you know, his last words were, "Oh my God, why did you forsake me? Eli, Eli, lama shevaktani." The word Eli, Eli, lama is Hebrew. Shevaktani is Aramaic. But the word, the verb, lishvok, to leave, God goes, "Why did you leave me?" The word lishvok, the verb lishvok, shevaktani, came into Hebrew. Its origins are Aramaic, but they're still used today. They're still used today. For example, when somebody dies, we say he left his life to the living ones because he died, so he lived. So in Hebrew, the word, the modern Hebrew even, is shavak chaim lekol chai. He left life to all the living. You see, in Hebrew. So Jesus spoke Hebrew. We have got inscriptions of Aramaic, but none of them are from the First Temple period. If there are Aramaic inscriptions, like on tombs and things, they are more or less from the time of Jesus and afterwards. It was a kind of a nicety. It was nice to show that you know Aramaic as well. The Talmud of Babylon is written only in Aramaic. You see, two very similar languages, they are sister languages, so it's not a great problem. For a Hebrew reader, to read Aramaic is not a great problem. It's not a great problem. You have to study it, but it is not ultra vires.
Hello. My name is Tarek, and I'm from Palestine, from the Palestinian occupied territories.
Yes.
I think what you said about UNESCO resolution is very misleading, and I invite everybody.
Speak slower because I don't hear you well.
I'm saying that what you have said about the UNESCO resolution is very misleading, and I invite everybody here. We have internet today to go back home and read it in details because they never denied the connection of the Jewish people with Jerusalem.
And how?
We can read the resolution in details in the UNESCO site. It's published. You are making funny about the stone written in old Hebrew language that they can call it Palestinian.
Yes.
For me, it's not a problem. They can call it Palestinian. I will still recognize it is Jewish.
Yes.
My question to you is, you prove. Thank you for the presentation. I got to know many things that I didn't know before in the connection of the Jewish people with Jerusalem.
Yes.
My question is, are you trying with your work somehow politically to influence the public to change their thinking about how Jerusalem looks like today and how it should supposed to look in the future? as for the last 2,000 years, there's so many people who crossed over the city and settled down. And the majority of the latest people who did are Arabs and then the Israelis, the Jewish Israelis. Are you trying somehow to influence the public to think that this should change how the old town and the Palestinian residents of the city now? Do you think that through your work you can convince them more that only a Jewish control and a Jewish residence should exist in that part? Mm-hmm. Yes, this is my main question. Thank you.
Good. So I would like to say something. I'm afraid you hit the wrong person. I'll tell you why. Because my interest in Jerusalem, in spite of what I'm talking here, and I hope that I'll have opportunity to come to Krakow again to speak about it, my interest in Jerusalem, this is what I'm writing a lot about and so on, is the Muslim city, the Crusader city, the Mamluk city, the Ayyubid city, and so on. So no one can accuse me of not being honest and even-handed to the Arab history of Jerusalem or the Muslim history of Jerusalem, because not all the Muslim rulers were Arabs. For example, the Ayyubids were not Arabs, the Mamluks were not Arabs, the Turks were not Arabs, yes? That's why we call the first period after the Muslims conquered the country till the Crusader, we call it Arab period or Muslim period. Later, we call it according to the others. But I want to tell you something, and I'm very frank about it. I work a lot about the history of the Temple Mount, where the temple is. I don't know if you know that all the Palestinian official policy is the temple never existed on the Temple Mount. This, you cannot challenge me, because this is what it is. The second thing, I don't know if people know that one of the problems for which peace cannot be obtained in the Middle East is that the Palestinians said they do not want to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. The moment they will recognize that we have got a past in this country and we are Jewish, Israel is a Jewish state, this moment there will be peace. So easy to make peace. Just admit that Israel is a Jewish state and that it existed in the past, and only because of political problems, conquest and so on, there was always Jewish presence in this country. It was never a moment where there were no Jews in the country. So how can somebody say, no matter how you put it, recognize, and I hope you do, recognize Israel as a Jewish country, recognize the Jewish presence in the country, and I promise you, in 2 minutes we can make peace, and I hope after the lecture you'll come and I'll shake your hand. Okay? Thank you. Yes, wait a minute.
Several years ago, there was great news that they apparently found the tomb of Jesus' family. What can you say about that?
Fantastic. You were not yesterday here, were you? Yes. I believe in the authenticity of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I believe that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was a place where Jesus was crucified and buried. Okay, that's a begin. Wait. God is with the patient one. It's a typical Arabic phrase. Now, is it right? Allah ma'asabrin ul ajil min shittan. Muzhek. Okay, now look. The story is as follows. For reasons I'll say of publicity. I'll tell you the true story as it was. Many years ago, came to be BBC Manchester. And they asked me to make a film when an archaeologist digging in Jerusalem and finds the tomb of Jesus, and the tomb is with bones inside. Oh, I thought it would be a sensational film. But then the whole night I was thinking, how can I do such a thing? It is to poke the eyes of Christianity. You cannot do such a thing. Because if the bones of Jesus is there, the whole story of the resurrection does not exist, right? And I told this journalist, I told, look, in Jerusalem was found a tomb where one, on each tomb, that, you know, ossuaries, there is a name of the deceased. So there were two Marys, there was Jesus, there was Judah, the son of Jesus, there was Matthew, and there was John. These were the names. Imagine, couldn't be better. Here you are, all Jesus and his family. Nonsense. It was sensational. It doesn't mean anything. Remember one thing. The name Mary was the most popular name amongst women. No surprise that the New Testament has got at least three Marys. The Jesus, Yeshua, the Redeemer in Hebrew, or God is the Redeemer, is very important because the period of Jesus was a period of oppression by the Romans. It was a period when people started to lose hope. So they said, God will redeem us. God will help. Jesus is a lot in Hebrew. Now in Hebrew, his name is Yehoshua. But in the Galilean accent or the Galilean way to say, they said Yeshua. You see, Yeshua. And later in the later literature, I don't know why it became Yeshu. But Yeshua, Yehoshua is all the same. Many. Now, the five names of the Maccabean rulers, like Judah, Simeon, John, again, Jonathan in Hebrew, Yochanan in Hebrew, and Elazar, were very, very popular. Very, very popular. So, as you see, all the names are very popular. So I'm not surprised that it was there. You know, women has got three. When you read all the names of the women in the time of Jesus, one will be called Salome. You know, Salome is very famous because of Richard Strauss and other. Salome, Miriam. That mostly, these are 90% of the women were called like that. How did you know which Miriam? When you speak about Miriam, which one it was, I don't know. It's a problem which I'm not acquainted with. But anyway, you see, it doesn't mean anything. You don't have to look for another tomb of Jesus, because the tomb in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre answers all what you need. Outside of the city wall, the first Christian evidence by the inscription I mentioned yesterday. It was a place which was a garden. There are tombs there. Not only Jesus' tomb, but also the other, like the tomb of Nicodemus and Joseph. All what you have need to have the background for the tomb of Jesus is there. So why to look for another name? Another place, I mean. You see? It was a sensational. You know, journalists sometimes make sensation.
Sometimes. So that was it. Any more questions before we... actually, we should finish right now, but yeah. One more question, please.
No.
So we'll save this question for the next year.
Yes.
And I want to thank again Professor Dan Bahat and his wife for coming to Krakow. And it's always great pleasure and honor. And honestly speaking, when I was listening to this lecture, it's few ideas came to my mind in terms of the next upcoming festival in 2019. So we'll discuss it in Jerusalem. And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. In more than half an hour, we'll have the last lecture of Professor Edwin Cerusi. Thank you so much.